So what does your theory of capital do that the other problematic theories do not?
I think that our theory does two things. The first thing is that it actually explains the accumulation of capital. And that's not a small thing, considering the fact that the other two theories cannot do that. And the second thing is that it comes with a new cosmology of capitalism, a cosmology that sheds a very different light on the past and the present and sometimes, I think, even on the future of this system. Now, I realize that these are very strong claims to make, so they need some elaboration. So let me first explain what is it that the other theories purport to do and to examine whether they actually deliver on that promise. And second, to try to sketch briefly what is it that our own theory does and why it does it differently than existing approaches. Now, as I mentioned earlier, existing theories of capital think of capital as a real thing. In other words, they think about it as an objective economic entity. And that means that it has a definitive material productive quantity, something that can be counted in clearly defined units. Now, each approach has its own building block, if you will, or elementary particle. The elementary particle of the liberal approach or the neoclassical approach is the util. And the elementary particle of the Marxist approach is what Marx calls socially necessary abstract labor time. If you follow the neoclassical logic and you want to illustrate it, you can say that, for instance, the quantity of capital that is owned by General Electric is, say, equal to the 1 billion units of utils that it can generate. So that will be a way of expressing what the quantity of capital from a liberal perspective would be. From a Marxist perspective, you would say that the quantity of capital that GE owns is proportionate or equal to the, say, 10 million years of socially necessary abstract labor that that capital took to produce. So each of these approaches has its own way of counting or enumerating the entity called capital. Now, utils and socially necessary abstract labor time are building blocks. They are the, if you like, the elementary substance that everything else is made of, and that it's the substance that explains, or supposed to explain, all the appearances of economics, whether from a liberal or from a Marxist perspective. So, if you wish, they are the reality behind the nominal structure of capitalist prices. Now, let's again concretize that, at least analytically. If the price of General Electric's capital, the capital stock of that company, is, say, 10 times bigger than the price of the capital that is owned by General Motors, a neoclassicist would conclude that General Electric's util generating capacity, its ability to generate utils, must be 10 times than the ability of General Motors. Similarly, from a Marxist perspective, that ratio of 10 to 1 would imply to a Marxist that it took 10 times the number of socially necessary abstract labor hours to produce the capital of General Electric relative to what it took to produce the capital of General Motors. So each of these numbers is proportionate to the underlying quantity, real quantity of the capital. So what we have here, again, in both approaches, we have what we call quantitative correspondence. The quantities that we measure in dollars and cents and that are readily observable are presumably a reflection of the substantive quantities that underlie them, and these quantities are measured in utils in the liberal case or in abstract labor time in the Marxist case. So that's more or less the common ground in terms of elementary particles in conventional political economy. Now, Unfortunately, this quantitative correspondence that is the basis of these theories is, I would dare say, totally illusionary. There are two reasons, I think, for this illusion. The first reason is that the correspondence is rooted in elementary particles that actually do not exist. So we argue and try to elaborate it at great length in our work and in our recent book that neither utils nor socially necessary abstract labor time can in fact be observed, even in principle. In other words, what we are saying is nobody will ever, ever get the Nobel Prize for discovering them because they don't exist. Now, this is something hard to prove in advance because maybe somebody will discover those units. But so far, nobody has discovered them. And the evidence is that both neoclassical economists and Marxist political economy measure these elementary particles, in fact, in reverse. In other words, instead of using utils that they know or abstract labor time that they know to explain the price of capital, they go the other way around. They explain util and abstract labor time by looking at the price of capital. Or to put it differently, they explain the cause by the effect instead of explaining the effect by the cause. So this is going scientifically in reverse. Now, the problem is that the cause, the utils or the abstract labor time, cannot be observed. And that means that whatever explanations these theories come up with, these explanations remain forever irrefutable because there's no way to actually say something concrete about the quantities of the cause. So that's the first problem. The problem is that the elementary particles of both of these theories, in fact, are illusionary. They do not exist. The second difficulty that leads to this illusionary quantitative correspondence is rooted in the curse of distortions, if you like. What do I mean by that? Even if we could do the impossible, and even if we could somehow miraculously measure utils and measure socially necessary abstract labor time, the entire effort would still be futile. And the reason is that these units are relevant, according to the theories themselves. They are relevant only under very strict conditions that can never exist. What do I mean by saying that? They require really a competitive economy in a state of spontaneous equilibrium with no external factors in order to be relevant. In other words, you can use utils and labor time only under conditions in which there is no government intervention, there are no distortions, there are no such things as economic policies, there are no large-scale corporate coalitions, there are no labor unions, there are no large consumer organizations. Economic agents, so-called, are completely rational. There is no irrationality, there are no externality, and so on and on and on. The point is that neoclassical economists and Marxist political economists admit quite readily that these interventions and distortions are not absent at all. In fact, they are rampant and they are permanent. You can say that from the very dawn of human history, there is no single instant of the so-called homo economicus that exists in a free market without power structures and state structures. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Once you have those markets becoming freer in inverted commas and more dominant, you have also states and power structures that stand behind them becoming more prominent. Now, the conclusion of that is that the analytical requirements of capital theory make the theory historical irrelevant. In other words, if we require no intervention, if we require no government, if we require no distortion, then the theory can really say nothing about the actual history it tries to explain that is full of those so-called distortions and interventions. So that's the second problem. Now, the net result of these two difficulties is that political economists end up living in a world of make-believe. They can see prices quite well. Everybody can. But they convince themselves that these prices represent some hidden reality But that reality can never be observed either directly or indirectly. Now, the problem is that when the ultimate cause is forever unobservable, we end up with theories of capital that have nothing to say about the reality of capital, because you do not have anything to explain this reality with, since your elementary particle doesn't exist. Now, this claim may seem surprising if you read the many hundreds and thousands of textbooks in microeconomics and business administration, etc., because they seem very scientific and they seem very pragmatic. But in fact, they are neither. If you check those books carefully, you see that the predictive record, and I mean not the prediction of the past, but the prediction of the future, is in fact extremely poor. And furthermore, that the predictions themselves have nothing to do whatsoever with utils or with socially necessary abstract labor time, because nobody knows what those units are. So whatever predictions they make, whether they're good or bad, these predictions have nothing to do with the elementary particles of the theories. Now, having given you that background, I would argue that our own theory is very different from the existing approaches, insofar that it starts from a very different cosmology. It develops very different theoretical concepts, theoretical hypotheses, and a very different empirical research program. And it certainly leads to very different conclusions. The key to our theory is power. We start by dispensing the belief that capital is a partial entity. Capital is, in our view, not a productive economic object that somehow ends up being distorted and augmented by power. Instead, capital is power, and capital is only power. It's nothing but power. Now, more broadly, we argue that the structure of society should be conceived not as a mode of production and consumption, but as a mode of power. So at all levels, at the level of capital and at the level of society as a whole, our focus right from the word go is power. Now, we argue that power has two faces. It has a qualitative face and it has a quantitative face. The qualitative face, the institutions and processes that create order, it's a word that we use to denote the creation of order. So it's both dynamic and static. These are the institutions and processes that reorder capitalist power. And these institutions include, of course, they include production, but also and consumption, but they also include things such as culture, ideology, formal politics, violence, religion, the law, international relations, and so on and on. Now, against this qualitative face stands the quantitative face. And that's the price of capital as quoted on the stock and bond markets. Now, this face is unique to capitalism. If you like, it's the algorithm that produces and that encompasses these qualitative processes of power into a singular dollar magnitude of capital. So we have two faces. We have a quantitative face that shapes capitalist power, and we have a quantitative face that reduces those qualitative features into a numerical magnitude. And to theorize capital, we argue, is to reason the correspondence between these two faces, the qualitative and the quantitative faces of capital. And here there is a big, big difference, I think, between this correspondence and the one that is professed by conventional political economy. In the conventional view, again, the correspondence is objective. It's an association between two quantities. But the problem is that one of these quantities is forever unobservable, and in our view, is fictitious. So the correspondence itself becomes fictitious, one that can never be demonstrated. Now, our correspondence is different. It's a correspondence between quality and quantity. So that correspondence can never be entirely objective. However, it's actually quite more robust. Why? Because both the qualitative and quantitative sides are fully observable. Both can be, in our opinion, reasoned and contested. And judged by the research that we have done over the past few decades, it leads to a set of systematic explanations and occasionally even to predictions that, in our view, is something that conventional approaches that are based on a non-existent entity can ever do. Now, the last and maybe crucial set of pieces in the puzzle are the twin notions of what we call dominant capital and differential accumulation. Let me try to elucidate a little bit these two concepts. First, the concept of differential accumulation. As I indicated earlier, capital represents quantified power. And when you speak about power, you always speak in relatives. So that's why we are emphasizing not accumulation per se, but differential accumulation, relative accumulation. If capital is power, you can never measure it absolutely. You can only measure it differentially. In other words, relative to other capitals. For instance, if General Electric accumulates in dollar terms twice as fast as General Motors, the conclusion that we would draw is that the power of General Electric has grown twice as fast as that of General Motors. And then we would try to reason this quantitative change, differential quantitative change, by examining the qualitative processes that drove it. The next point here is the concept of dominant capital. Differential accumulation as a measurement of power suggests that it's not enough, or it's at least not sufficient, to deal with capital in the abstract or as a totality. Instead, you have to understand capital as a structure of power. And you have to focus not only on it in the abstract, you have to start dissecting its leading entities, or what we call dominant capital. Organizationally, dominant capital is conceived in our work as some sort of an interlocking web that constitutes the leading corporations and the key governmental military organizations that exist at the center of the political economy. And we think of the differential accumulation of these entities as represented by the differential capitalization, a concept that maybe I can have a chance to explain later, of the leading corporations at the center. And we think of this differential accumulation as being the driving force of capitalist society. So we have a notion of capital that is very different from the existing approach. And if we think about this notion, in other words, capital as power rather than as a substantive productive entity, that implies a fairly significant cosmological change. It means that we need to transcend the materialistic notion of a mode of production and to think more broadly about the cosmology of modes of power. And I think that the benefit of that shift is that it puts many capitalist institutions and phenomena in a totally different light, different than the way they are explained by existing approaches. I give you a few examples from subjects that we have written about in the past. For instance, take the instances of Middle East conflict. Usually these conflicts are thought of as aspects of international relations. And in our work in the 1990s and during the early 2000s, we show that these conflicts can be much more systematically understood as integral to the differential accumulation processes of certain factions within dominant capital globally. So we anchored these conflicts in the accumulation process in quite a systematic way, I think, as opposed to the international relations perspective that dominates the analysis of these conflicts. Or another illustration, in the early 90s, Israel and Palestine started peace negotiations, and in parallel, the South African apartheid regime came to a close. Now, both of these processes are usually, or regime shifts, if you like, are usually seen as domestic regional processes and analyzed from that perspective. But again, in our research, we showed that, in fact, you cannot properly understand them unless you situate them in the changing process of global accumulation. And we, I think, showed with quite a bit of evidence that that transition was predicated on significant transformations that were taking place during that period in the process of capital accumulation globally, and forced both of these regime changes to take place at the time. Or take phenomena such as mergers and acquisitions or stagflation. Usually these phenomena, these particular phenomena are considered as external anomalies, if you like, or distortion. Economists don't like the term stagflation. They invented it particularly in order to denote anomaly in economic theory. Mergers and acquisitions, they are considered one of the 10 mysteries of finance. There's actually no explanation for, no systematic or at least agreed upon explanation for why mergers and acquisitions take place in the first place. So these are anomalies or distortions of business and economics. And in our work, we took these anomalies and tried to show that, in fact, they are integral and they are significant driving forces in the evolution of modern capitalism and the processes of differential accumulation. Now, these types of sort of refocusing of political economy that come from our approach led us to rethink completely even broader concepts, such as the broader concept of the state. The state is usually thought of as an entity that is external to accumulation, either that it distorts accumulation, the liberals think in this way usually, or that supports it, which is the Marxist view. But in our work, we suggested an alternative conceptualization of the state in which it is understood as a mode of power. So the state is not an entity, but the state is the broader mode of power that we call capitalism. And therefore, we speak about the state of capital. So as you move the focus from capital as a material productive entity to capital as power, the entire cosmology is transformed. And as I suggested, it leads to very, very different perception of what constitutes accumulation, what constitutes capitalist development, etc.